Committee on Elections and Rules on Saturday, April 9, 2005, at 9 a.m. at the Pendleton Center for the Arts and Pendleton.
I hear you recommended some of the writing on that you started with. Am I ready? We'll call to order this Saturday morning meeting of the House Committee on Elections and Rules. Thank you all for being here. What a great turnout for this early morning. We've had a great venue, and we've enjoyed your city for the 12 hours that we've been here. We came from Heppner last night, so I think it was a first for all of us, but it's great to be here this morning. So we'll start off with introductions of the committee. I will start down here with Representative Mitch Greenman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still representing Mitch Greenman. I represent House District 33, which is northwest Portland River, all the way 20 miles or so west to the beautiful wine country of Helvetia.
Good morning, and thank you for coming. I'm Paul Holdley. I'm from Eugene. I represent District 8, which is mostly central and south Eugene, and goes west to Notai, if anybody knows where that is, and then goes south of the county line and takes in Lorraine and several wineries, some private forest and state forest lands. And I also went to high school in La Grande, which is just over the mountain from here.
And Representative Benjamin Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kim Thatcher. I come from Kaiser, just north of Salem. My district goes up into St. Paul, where they also have a rodeo, and up to Newburgh. And I was actually here a couple of weeks ago for judiciary.
Great, thank you. Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Barry Dalton. I represent Oregon's 21st House District in Salem, mostly northeast Salem, a little bit of south of Salem. And I'm fortunate to have the governor's mansion in my district, Mahoney Hall. I also serve on the House Health and Human Services Committee, which I chair. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jim Delker. I am the chairman, Representative Derek Kitts, from Hillsborough, Washington County, and thank you so much for having us here. It's great to be here. The last introduction that we have has been the good representative slash chairman of a different committee. He's serving as not only a member of our committee today, and he worked very hard to convince me to come over here to Pendleton. It wasn't that hard. But he asked if I'd come over to Pendleton. I said, absolutely. Love to hear what the folks in Pendleton and each door would have to say about some of the stuff that we discussed in the Capitol. So you can thank Representative Jensen, or you can blame him, depending on which way you want to go at the end of this committee hearing. So Representative Jensen, please. I'm sure you need more introduction here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank all the members of the committee for coming to Pendleton. We understand that some of you have helped our local economy already since you've been here. We appreciate the wisdom of the committee in choosing the Arts Center as a place to come, because that will give you a further opportunity to contribute to the well-being of the economy of the great city of Pendleton here. So, all things, we're very pleased that you're here, Representative.
Thank you.
I am State Representative Bob Jensen. I'm from House District 58. Pendleton is part of the seat of the population of my district, which is, I think all of you know, includes also Hermiston and the smaller surrounding communities. So, in the Hermiston and Pendleton area. And it is really a pleasure to be here in Pendleton. We appreciate all of you coming this morning, and hope that we'll be able to answer some of your questions on some of these issues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. If we don't know the answers, we know people that do know the answers. So, thank you again, folks, for being here. At this time, colleagues, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2774. If you wouldn't mind reading the bill summary for the folks here today and for the committee members, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and committee, HB 2774 extends time for the electorate in the irrigation district to obtain a replacement ballot. It passed, especially allow an irrigation district to provide replacement ballots in a similar manner as county election offices now provide fishing and testing ballots to electors.
Thank you, Cletus. At this time, we have one person signed up to testify on behalf of this bill, Lisa Baum, who is also with us in Heckner last night. So thank you for being here today.
Chairman Kitt, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Baum. I work for West Extension Irrigation District and I'm here testifying on behalf of Oregon Water Resources Congress. This bill will allow us to make sure that if someone has lost or destroyed or spilled coffee on the ballot, that they have an opportunity to vote up to and including the day of the election if it's a mail-in election, that we'll be able to offer a replacement ballot to them, and we encourage your support of this bill.
Lisa, thank you so much. I appreciate you being here today. Are there any questions? I know that we discussed this bill, but last night, Representative Delco.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I did have a question. I'm not sure if we got to it yesterday. Did you say how many irrigation districts there were across the state?
I believe that in the written testimony that Christina submitted, she has that information. I don't know the answer to that, but I can have Anita contact you next week with that information.
Okay, just a curiosity. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Delbrook. Members, Christine McRib is the lobbyist for the Oregon Water Resources Congress in Salem. I submitted written testimony for your review. I talked to me prior to the committee in Salem, and I was unable to know before today as a result of family commitments. We gave her a pass on that and said that's just fine. Take care of your family, it's more important. So she submitted written testimony for the committee if there are any questions. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I do have one more question.
Representative Delco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the vote by mail, we get to have a ballot as many as 21 days ahead of the actual election. How does that work for an irrigation district election?
The statutes under Oregon Revised Statutes 545 are similar. We mail the ballots not sooner than 21 days and not later than 14 days before the election.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That was involved with your question. Is there any other discussion? Seeing them, thank you very much.
Chairman Kitt, thank you.
Colleagues, is there any further discussion on the bill? If not, we intend to move it, so I will close the public hearing and I will open a work session.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Thatcher.
I move House Bill 2774 on the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves House Bill 2774 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? So, Annette, will you please call the roll?
Representing Gallo.
Votes aye.
Representing
Carr.
Representing
Greenberg. Aye.
Representing
Holby. Aye.
Representing
Martin.
Excused.
Representing Atkins.
Aye.
And
Cherokee. Votes aye. The bill, House Bill 2774, receiving the affirmative, will pass and will go to the floor with the pass recommendation. Representative Clark is excused. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Thank you, colleagues, for your assistance on that bill and your support. At this time, I will do just a bit of an explanation for those that are here. A public hearing in the legislature allows for bills to be discussed and vetted out, if you will. A work session is required for the bill to actually have a vote to go to the floor, which will be voted on by the entire House of Representatives at that time. We discussed this bill, we discussed it last night in Heckner and in previous meetings in Salem, so why don't you pass the bill here since it's more applicable in this area than it is in Salem or in Hillsborough for that matter. So that's why the expedience of that. We've read the bill, we've discussed the bill, it's not just like it came today and we're passing it out, so I just wanted to clarify that for everybody. We're very thankful. Representative Jensen, would you be so inclined to carry this bill on the floor?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you, Representative.
President Dalton was suggesting a possible consent calendar.
Yeah, I agree with consent calendar.
The chairman entertain a motion to place it on the consent calendar. So no objection. We'll place House Bill 2774 on the consent calendar. What the consent calendar is, for those that are here, is it limits the debate on the floor, doesn't allow the politicians in Salem to go on about a bill such as this, but placing the consent calendar, there's no debate on it. It's a straight yea or nay vote. We'll go to the Senate and come back. If there's no amendments on the Senate side, it'll go straight to the governor's desk. So just keeping up the speed. Thank you. At this time, we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3127. Thank you. So please come back to the bill summary of House Bill 3127.
Chair Committee, House Bill 3127 modifies the definition of business under the Oregon Government Standards and Prices Law to exclude certain nonprofit corporations with which people, which a public official or a relative of a public official is associated.
Thank you, Lewis. At this time, on House Bill 3127, we'll call forward Justin Burns.
Thank you for being with me, Justin.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My name is the committee. Justin Burns, a Coy Valeroo local law firm representing Oregon Trail Electric Company. We requested this bill through Representative Jensen. As far as factual background, Oregon Trail Electric Company has a board member who is also an electrical inspector. The board would like to be able to pay that electrical inspector a stipend for appearing at the board meetings as it does all of its directors. The company requested of the Ethics Commission an opinion as to whether that was proper under the ethics statutes. We believed it was, but under an abundance of caution, we requested that opinion. The Ethics Commission looked into the situation, ruled that there was no conflict of interest, but notwithstanding the absence of a conflict of interest, decided that that situation was prohibited under the statute. It was prohibited conduct, curiously, because the definitions of business under the conflict of interest provisions are different than they are under the prohibited conduct provisions, which I believe is just an anomaly. I don't believe it was intended. The company introduced last session a bill to resolve this problem. The language was different. The language was amended into the omnibus ethics legislation that was proposed last session. That language was modified, did not entertain any opposition from anyone, including the Ethics Commission, was both part of the omnibus bill, which was passed by both houses and vetoed by the governor. We're back again with the same legislation, the same language, with no opposition. The Ethics Commission does not oppose the amendment. I think Sandy Flicker has provided some materials to the committee describing that, and we ask for your support.
Justin, thank you so much. Again, colleagues, Sandy Flicker, the executive director of the Oregon Rail Electric Co-ops, talked to me prior to the committee and asked if she could submit written testimony. I said that was absolutely fine. She said she should have Justin testify here today, and I said that would absolutely suffice. So, let me do that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understand, the language is critical on line 15 and 16 of the bill. Could you help me with something on that?
Sure.
Yes. As I'm reading this now, and you can help me with this, before the addition of a relative and only as a member director, now it would only include a public official associated in a non-remunerative position. This represents two changes now, right? In one hand, it adds the relatives of the public official, as well as the public official. But on the other hand, it also allows a public official under this definition to be associated as a director, even if there is a remuneration for being a director. Is that correct?
Correct. And I should clarify, the language, the first change you identified, which I did not mention, relative of the public officials, was language which legislative council is proposing to all the ethics statutes to inform that. So that is not a change we requested. We placed that in at the request of legislative council, and that's not something we're particularly interested in. But you are correct. The change we have requested clarifies that a member or director, and this relates only to nonprofits, that serves for a nonprofit or a person serving in a non-immunity capacity is not associated with a business for the purposes of the conflict statutes. This parallels the definition of business in the definition of an actual and potential conflict of interest. I have the statute here with me. The definition of conflict of interest exempts people who are members or directors of a nonprofit organization totally. The definition of business in the prohibited conduct statute refers back to this statutory definition, which does not exempt members and directors of nonprofit corporations, only persons who are associated with nonprofit corporations in a non-immunity capacity. So by adding this language in the definition section of the ethics statute, it conforms the definition of business in the actual and potential conflict of interest provisions in the same statute, if that makes sense.
Yes,
I may follow up.
Yeah, I'm a board member of the North Coast Health Foundation, and I receive a modest remuneration for attending meetings of that foundation. I list that on my conflict of interest form now, and I guess this is almost in the sense of stating a conflict. This change would mean that I would be exempt from even listing that association on my conflict of interest form with the government standards and whatever it is commissioned. Is that right?
I'd have to think about that. I'd have to look at the reporting statute, but that...
Well, at least take away the apparent conflict. I mean, if there was any potential conflict.
Well, yes and no, because we're not changing the definition of nonprofit for the purpose of the conflict rules for which you're required to report that conflict.
Okay.
This just changes the definition of business as it relates to the prohibited conduct statute. But I, out of abundance of caution, you know, it might still be worth your while to note that conflict. And that was the problem we had in our situation, is the Ethics Commission said, notwithstanding that there is no conflict of interest, whether or not you can disclose that interest to get around the potential conflict of interest is irrelevant, because under the Commission's reading of the definition of business under the prohibited conduct statute, that conduct was prohibited whether or not the conflict was disclosed.
Mr. Chair, please follow up. No, I'm not following up. If we are going to have a work session on this, I think I probably do need to put into the record a potential conflict, because I think it may change my position relative to this.
Representative, if you'd like, you take that modest compensation and some direction over to me, and more than happy to declare the conflict myself.
I don't think we can use 501c3 money in a political campaign, so you'll have to convince me to contribute directly, I think.
Thank you. That makes sense to convince her.
I do apologize for the convoluted explanation. It's very detailed and complicated to get here and then to resolve it in this. Apparently that was after much negotiation.
Maybe to Representative Green, I can do that. Carl, is there any further discussion on this bill? Or this testifier? Thank you, Justice.
Thank you. We appreciate your opinion, Jonathan, and Representative Jensen's assistance.
You bet.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Now, at this time, I'll be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3127. I will open a work session.
knows that I may have a conflict of interest.
Governor Greenwood knows that he may have a conflict of interest with regards to the substance of this bill.
I need a motion.
Chair, you have a motion.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm in House Bill 3127 before with the D-Pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves House Bill 3127 to the floor with the D-Pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I just do want to point out to the audience today that under House rules, we're required to report a conflict if we have a potential conflict, but we're also still required to vote on the measure, so I will be voting on this.
The further clarification, if a member has a conflict, they simply have to declare the conflict, but they're required, if they're present, to vote on the measure. So, in the essence of sunshine law, the vote passed in 1974 in Congress, which is where that comes from. So, thank you so much. Seeing no further discussion on House Bill 3127 and noting that Representative Wheeler has declared a potential conflict of interest, and then I can call the roll.
Representative
Gallo.
Aye.
Excused.
Representative
Greenwood. Aye. Representative Colby. Aye. Representative Carnes. Excused. Representative
Andrews.
Aye. Chair Gibbs. Aye. House Bill 3127 receiving the required number of votes will be moved to the floor with the D-Pass recommendation. Representative Jensen. Saying that you are the sponsor of House Bill 3127, would you honor us in carrying the second bill for this committee?
I don't think I can carry
the
bill.
The dean of the Oregon Legislature has agreed to carry the bill. House Bill 3127 on the floor. So noted. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Jensen.
Explain to the audience what dean means. Survived the process longer than other members of the legislature.
I'm going to take exception to that. My name is Representative Jensen is the dean of far more than simply having longevity. He's a dean of wisdom and experience, and we all look to him for a great deal.
As a side note, we were in great debate last session on the House floor, and the young representative from Hillsdale made a motion on the floor that the not as young representative from Pendleton wouldn't approve that, and it was noted in the paper that the senior member of the Oregon Legislature chastised the younger member of the Oregon Legislature. So it is with great respect that I acknowledge Representative Jensen as the dean, that he is truly what Oregonians want and expect of the Oregon legislators. So
he's even not the only one that chastised that person in the last session.
I was accused of legislative malpractice. I knew there was such a thing, but I was accused of it, so that's so noted. Thank you, colleagues. At this time, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2583.
House Bill 2583 requires evidence of citizenship for individuals registering to vote for the first time in Oregon. Declares emergency to be effective upon passage.
Thank you, Cletus. House Bill, may I have a sign-up sheet? House Bill 2583 has been one of the center points of this committee's work in traveling statewide. This committee is doing more stops in more cities than probably all the other committees combined, I think. We've been hitting 9 different cities dealing with elections reforms and potential problems. If there are any, just trying to have a preemptive strike of not allowing Oregon to become a Washington state, as we're seeing in the governor's race, or Florida, as you saw in the presidential election, or have any concerns like you saw in Ohio in this presidential election. So we're dealing with various elections reforms, whether there needs to be any changes or not. is still determined by this committee. So House Bill 2583 is one of those center points that we have traveled around the state hearing testimony from each and every city that we've stopped in. So we have four people signed up to testify on this bill today. I will call forward at this time Charlotte McIver. I hope I said that right. I butchered somebody's name in advance. I'm sorry.
My name is Charlotte McIver. I am the county clerk and election officer for Valala County, and I live in Enterprise, Oregon. I wish to state that at this time I oppose the passing of House Bill. I'm sorry, I got the right one here. House Bill 2583. Basically, I have no problem with the concept of the bill. I think that we should always be making sure that our registered voters are citizens of our state and registered voters or residents of the state of Oregon. What I am concerned about is the administrative process that would enable us to complete this task. I'm also concerned about the disenfranchising of voters who may not be able to supply us with this information in a timely manner in which to allow them to vote in a particular election that they're trying to register for. Because we are a motor voter registration state by legislation, we obtain a great many of our registration by mail and through the Department of Motor Vehicles. Will the new registered voter need to mail in this information or produce it to DMV? Will DMV have to forward it to the election office? How do you determine whether this person is a first-time voter in Oregon? These are just a few of, I'm going to be very brief about this. This is just a few of the administrative processes that the clerk's office or the election offices will have to deal with. Unless we go back to the days when you were required to go into the county clerk's office to register, and we identified you more fully than we do now by the mail-in process of the registration law, I believe that we have a lot of disenfranchised voters if we don't watch that process. This is my testimony at this time, and I urge the committee to oppose the passing of this House Bill 2583.
Charlotte, thank you so much for your testimony. We're looking at it. We're having breakfast this morning together, as we do frequently. One of the things that was brought up as almost a side note, I just wanted to get your feedback since I have you here.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody doesn't sign the ballot, currently, if the county clerk has enough time, they'll try to track down that person. As you get closer to the election, your time frame is squished, for lack of a better word, and you're unable to call and track down those people that didn't sign those ballots. Also, those people that do vote via mail order and drive by and drop off their ballot, let's hypothetically say at 7:55 p.m. on election day before the 8 o'clock deadline, if they don't sign that ballot, they're out of luck. Am I understanding that policy correctly?
Well, you are, as far as if they have not signed their ballot.
Right.
Okay. The ballot envelope, I should say. The ballot envelope is required to be signed when it's in our possession by 8 p.m. election night.
Okay.
But if you're talking about the fact that
What was your first question? I'm sorry.
it was basically that if somebody turns in that ballot at X time prior to the election, you as a county clerk have time to track that person down. As you get closer to the election, your time constraints get narrowed. And you're unable to track down that person, therefore that ballot would not be counted as a...
If it's an unsigned ballot envelope, that is correct. We would, in case of maybe a signature not being adequately matching the signature we have on file, we do have a process in which we can, as long as it's been signed.
But that's a good question. Not matching versus unsigned or
not able to be counted.
Okay.
But we do our best to, because a small community like ours, we track down their sister or their brother or whoever we can to make sure we can make contact with that voter. We rarely, we have very few envelopes that are not approved because of non-signatures. It's just simply possible they're just not in the county at the time. But, we'll have two within an election. But yes, that is definitely a problem.
I apologize.
Be a problem.
I appreciate that. In fact, my father actually sent my birth certificate back because I was Republican. So,
safeguard it, because it's a pretty high level of information. And actually, I did remember what I was going to say. I received my passport when I turned 18, right even before I registered to vote, because I was going on a trip to Argentina and I needed a passport to travel. And it didn't seem, from my perspective, too much of a hardship to be able to produce what I now have. Two passports now in my lifetime to prove citizenship, and I don't think that's a real significant imposition if you are interested to participate. And so, I suppose people make the argument that voting is a right, but citizenship is a responsibility, and we all have a responsibility, in my opinion, to vote as part of being active citizens and responsible citizens. And so I would think that as a measure of responsibility, you think, I want to exercise my franchise, I want to participate, and there are a couple of steps that I have to take, but they're just steps along the way to being a responsible citizen. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that. So there's 2 points.
That was 2 questions in the one. Very sneaky, but so
good. Part of my written testimony, I do ask some of those same questions if this bill passed. I wonder what we're supposed to do with the provided document. I have some concern whether we can even ask the people to photocopy those and provide those to us, because under the Body Records Administration, Administrative Rule 333-011-01-1, under subsection 6, it says that no person shall photograph before a certified birth, death, or whatever, except while the state subdivision county registrars or their deputies acting in accordance with their official duties. So I have, since I have been a clerk, which is 20 years, I have always had this nice little piece of paper above our photocopy machine for all my staff so that they know that they are not to photocopy U.S. passports, naturalization papers, or U.S. birth certificates. We can copy it according to this paper, whatever we want to still print, but it would be a concern I think we need to check. I would feel very guilt at ease to ask you to provide something to us. And you're not going to send the original certain to us.
No.
So I have some questions about that too. And how, and then once we get them, if we get them, how long will we keep them? Will they be public record, open to public inspection and copy? And will we reject the hospital birth certificate, which is what we do when we do passports? And it doesn't quite define exactly where we're to go with this. I just feel uncertain about that also.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Representative Thatcher will ask the final question of this panel.
Okay. On this chart. Well, can I make it a good one?
Final question, Sue.
Okay. It's my understanding that you do go back to the Help America Vote Act minimal registration requirements, that you send out a letter. Do you have a notation, and do you maintain a notation next to voters who have not provided that minimal? Okay. You want one of us to answer? you all maintain. We have to change our software and our program and our computer, which did cost us money, to keep track, and we can provide lists of the people that have not provided that to us. And we as a client, like, you know, we were supposed to send out two letters to people to remind them before the last election to do this. We even went so far as to do three. And I even threatened to go visit them at their house because it was important to us to try and follow that, but it was really a hard thing to do when we were being instructed that they get counted anyway. So, okay.
Representative Thatcher, if I could answer too, and we're just so much smaller than Harlan County, Melville County, and Iowa. And of course, we don't have a computer program that we are able to do that. The Central Voter Registration System, soon to be had, will provide that to us. But we have just a hand register of those people that we haven't been able to get to update their registration.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here today. I appreciate you traveling all the way from Vail, stayed at the Bates Motel.
You never stayed there.
Right? You can build that over there. It's a dead area, a good people, and you guys are doing a great job of making sure those people get to vote. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being here. This time we'll call forward, I believe it's Patty Chapman.
Committee members, I'm not going to testify on this bill, but I do, for the record, I would like to submit written testimony
and
opposition.
Patty, if you could just state your name for the record and that you're submitting testimony for the record in the written form, it would be wonderful. Thank you.
My name is Patty Chatham, and I'm the election manager. And I'm the elections manager for Unitile County, and I'm submitting testimony on behalf of my county commissioners on House Bill 2583.
Thank you so much for being here today. Committee will show note in your written testimony. At this time, we'll call forward Benjamin Talley.
Thank you, legislator. My name is Ben Talley. I want to first thank Representative Jensen, the Dean of the House, for his wisdom in giving me and us this civics lesson. It's been great for me. I'm in opposition to this. I just want to say a few sentences. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. I'm here to express my opposition to House Bill 2583. The two or three reasons I'll read off is that the photocopy of the identification is indicating the current name and address is already required. And it's important to note that falsely swearing that citizenship on the registration is already a Class C felony. And third, the issue by enacting other ID requirements like this bill will require quite a chilling effect, I think, on citizens and registering themselves to vote. Last, I want to say in the words of Secretary of State Bradbury,
ways. And the simple truth is that the bill is unnecessary at best and uncomfortable at worst, and I respectfully urge the committee to reject House Bill 2583. In the words of my wife, mechanic's daughter, Judy, who's raised in Kansas, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So that's all I have to say.
But they did a very appreciate you giving your comments on the public record. It's people like you, which is why we're going out there and getting feedback on not just this bill, but a little village committee here. So thank you so much for being here.
I thought you also said we're not in Kansas anymore.
Colin, at this time, no one else has signed up to testify in House Bill 2583. So I will close the public hearing for the eighth time on this bill. At this time, we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2551. Cletus, if you could read the bill summary on House Bill 2551.
Mr. Chair, HB 2551 prohibits opening of return and revocation secrecy envelopes in elections conducted by mail until 8:30 a.m. Prohibits ballot drop sites and styles by persons other than election officials.
Colin, at this time, Patty, if you have, are you going to testify on this bill, or are you going to just submit it?
I don't think
I'm going
to submit
it. I will call you forward first, and then I will call up the three county clerks that are here at the same time. Call on you.
Can I ask the local county clerk a question as she's submitting testimony as well as the other? Could I ask her a question? I'm not sure whether she was going to specifically testify, but I'd like to ask each of the county clerks that respond to the question if I'm wrong.
We will make them up, absolutely, please. Thank you. Can you state your name for the record?
I'm Patty Chapman, Unicoi County Elections Manager. I would like to talk briefly on what the impact of House Bill 2151 would be for Unicoi County. It would have a significant effect on our overall election costs, the cost involved of training additional staff and also securing additional workspace for our election boards. To open the envelopes for the pre-inspection process and ballot counting. Section 1 prohibits opening the return identification and secrecy envelopes until 8:30 a.m. on the day of election. And to us, that means we would be really fortunate to have 10 or 15% of our total votes cast counted by 8 p.m. on election night, if that were so. And as it is now, with that 7 days. we would be really fortunate to have 10 or 15% of our total votes cast, counted by 8 p.m. on election night, if that were so. And as it is now, with that 7-day lead time that we currently have, for example, in a general election in 2004, we have the vast majority of our votes counted by 8 p.m. Probably, I would say 93 to 95% of everything we have was counted. And we were able to finish up and go home by 2:30 in the morning. If this passed, to do the same thing in one day, we would have to hire an additional, I'm estimating, 32 more board workers on top of the current amount we already employ. Which, if you're going to increase the ratio of the full-time staff to temporary employees, there's going to be a much greater risk for error that we currently don't have. This timeline allows us to ensure that we can flip to it. We have our checks and we have our balances, and it allows us the time that I feel is necessary for us to do the detailed and exacting work that it takes to pre-inspect and tabulate all the ballots that we have. We're currently able to account for every ballot that's returned to our office. And we can accurately count each of those ballots. And under those time constraints, I feel that this House bill jeopardizes our fundamentally sound rules and procedures that we have.
Patty, thank you so much for testifying. I think that your concerns about the bill are not unique. I mean, we're hearing these sorts of things across the states. We travel around discussing these bills. It's the great thing about traveling around the state is you actually get out of the fishbowl and go into Salem and talk to real people and understand the ramifications of the brilliant ideas that those 90 legislators come up with while in the building. So thank you so much for being here. See, no questions?
Yeah, no, I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'd like to ask each.
I'd like to ask you about Section 1. The Section 1 comes out of, I don't want to say paranoia, but out of the fear that there can be fraudulent things happening between the time a ballot is received and the time it's actually counted. And this actually became a big fuss in the metro area because the radio personality that made this a big issue, so there are a lot of very late ballots. I wonder whether you, and I'll ask each of the others who will testify, whether there's ever been an allegation in your county that there was some fraudulent things happened between the time a ballot was received and removed from the secrecy envelope and the actual counting of ballots?
I've worked in the our election department since 1988, and personally, that has never been an issue. It's never came up. This past general election was the first election that we actually had observers into our office watching each step from the signature verification process to watching our boards pre-inspect our ballots in preparation to have those counted, and also the tabulation process from beginning to end. And I feel it was a very positive experience for those that watched. Yeah, I think we were very enlightened by what we actually do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for taking the time to document your testimony. That helps. We does help the committee be able to, cite, obvious objections to the bill. On the flip side. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
This time I will call forward my three county clerks. Very good. You've submitted written testimony. You don't need to read it to the committee. We'll read it. We can read it ourselves. But please, more of a candid discussion of the bill is greatly appreciated. So, please state your name for the record.
My name is Representative Kix, sorry, Chair. My name is Charlton Pfizer. I'm the Wallowa County Clerk and Election Officer for Wallowa County and live in Enterprise, Oregon.
I'm David Long, Wallowa County Clerk from Vail, Oregon.
Tammy Green, Baker County Clerk, Baker City, Oregon.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I guess maybe I'll be first. Committee members, again, of course, I'm wishing to oppose 2551. Patty from Eamon Hill County made a very good presentation of how a lot of us clerks feel. I also had observers to our last November 2004 election. We had observers before, but not in the as many as we had this last time. The observers watched our whole process from the ballots being ballot envelopes being received in, our off-site process, and the opening process of the envelopes, as well as the counting process. And I will tell you, I wish some of them could have been here today to speak to you, but they were greatly impressed by the Oregon's election process and the security that we put in protecting the ballots. Just for a little insight again, it's another situation where a small county does their process a little differently than a big county because of the process, but because of our limited space, we are provided a election storeroom which has another inner room which we double lock during the election process, where every night when the election boards go home, that those ballots that have been that are in the pre-inspection process and have been removed from the envelope go into a tub, a lockable tub that for each precinct that we are processing. Those tubs are sealed with numbered seals and are listed on the register by the election boards themselves, the chair and the election boards. That inner door is double locked. One of the chair people will take one of the keys. These are single key locks. One of those keys are sent home with one of the chair people. The other key is left with the election office, so that the election office is unable to enter that facility unless we want to take a crowbar to the door.
Might be noticed.
And of course, the chairperson or the election boards are not able to access those envelopes. So we do take a great deal of trouble to go through a secure process to make sure that the ballots are handled with care and security all through the election process, and we're very proud of our process. I think this compression of the election opening process will greatly jeopardize our respected accuracy for our elections as we have today. And I'll just kind of leave it at that so the next person can make their statement.
Chair Kitts, committee members, I also would oppose this bill for several reasons.
one of the main wonderful things about our system we have in Oregon is that it is highly supervised and monitored. And where it's done right in the building, right under the clerk's nose, we know what's going on. And when we used to have elections at the polling places, it would like be the next day and we go, oh my God. So I have to say I have conducted elections under both forms. And I believe this is by far the most safe and secure system of the two. When we first did what I know, I was not fine with it. I was quite frank. I really had some reservations. I knew I came from a very conservative community, and I knew that they liked they call it their social get-together. Some of them even had food sales. And it was a struggle to do it daily in my community because I felt politically reminding me that I am an elected official. I'm trying to do what they choose, you know, to do. But I have to say that it's been unbelievable the amount of people that come to me just openly, just seeing me with their sentence that I really want you to know. I love what I know. And I would hate to say that 4 years ago, whenever we had the two ballots with the 26 measures, that we would go back to those days where we had to stand in line. I also want to tell you I have a young nephew who tried to vote in Idaho this year. His first presidential election. He went to work, went to the polls before work. He stood in line out in the polling lane for 2 hours, he told me, and he still wasn't inside the building. He went back after work. He still did not get to vote. And I want you to know that I really feel like with the federal government stepping in proper and with all the other problems that are associated with the other systems, but I feel that this is by far the best. The other thing is I think if they tried to hurry this through human nature, and you cannot believe until you have worked in an election office, you are taking like huge days up until the election day. Huge, big, long, stressful days. And then you get hit from like 6:30 in the morning until 3 or 4 at night. The chance of error, if we had to go on and on and on to count those ballots, would just be greater and greater. Plus the cost is going to be, greatly enlarged by trying to get all that done in a facility to do it in. You know, I'm in a small community where we don't have a place to set up all the equipment that would be necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. Gary?
Chair Kidd, committee members. I too am opposed to House Bill 2551. I come from a small county also. We simply do not have the funds to rent a building to conduct an election in. Our courthouse was built in 1909. It's a beautiful building, but we are very limited with space. We do the best we can with the space that we do have. The cost is the biggest factor, of course. Also, we would have to hire more personnel to go ahead and do these elections. I have a small pool of people to pool fund to work in election as it is. It's very hard to find people that can work in election. And it's getting smaller. We pay minimum wage. It's a hard job. It's a very difficult job. I would like to echo my two colleagues' sentiments on the proofing of the ballots, the time that we take to do that. It's extremely important that we take close care of every single ballot. Every vote has to count. Everyone. We cannot rush this process.
You touch on some very fundamental things and issues that are raised as a result of the costs, the 1909 building in space. We did the same thing we had there. We have a beautiful courthouse. We just don't have a lot of space in our courthouse. These sorts of things are consistent throughout the testimony that we hear. And I don't want the impression out there that this committee or the legislature thinks you're doing anything wrong
committee's objective is to simply prevent something from happening if we have cracks in the existing structure. But I'll just cite Florida folks. I ran the campaign for the Escambia County Supervisor of Elections, which is your position in Florida. Great person, great guy. Their system, as they were instructed to implement it, had fractures that were not brought out until the 2000 election. And all of a sudden, they were filing election law day by day. Hanging chads, dimple chads, pregnant chads. There were more chads in the state of Florida than in the entire world at that point. So I say that. I don't want the illusion that this committee feels, but we think you're doing a great job, and we think you have a huge amount of responsibility bestowed upon you, especially with the percentage of voter turnout that our state has. And that has increased your responsibility, and you guys are doing a great job. I just want to, for the record, state that we don't think you're doing anything wrong. We just want to make sure that if situations were to arise, how we deal with them, and if there are cracks in our structure, that we patch them before they break. So I appreciate you guys being here, and your testimony is so valuable to the entire committee, and I will speak on behalf of the committee. We do appreciate you traveling from Vail and Baker. And I know Representative Delco's committee is heading to Baker today. We have to leave at 11 o'clock, so I will keep my comments short. But thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate it.
Hey, kids, can I just address what you were saying?
Go ahead.
You addressed the issue in regards to, you know, the cracks. I will tell you that the Oregon Association of County Clerks and the Secretary of State's office, since I've been in, and long before I came in the office, I've been in office 16 years, have addressed election problems sincerely for all those years. That's why you do presently, one of the reasons, along with the legislature, have the election laws that, the good election laws that we have today, and the vote by mail, and any time that we feel that there is a crack or a potential crack, we are the first to jump up and run to the legislature to say this needs to be fixed. And so this happens to be one place that we really don't feel needs to be fixed. We think we have a good process.
I think we do have a good process, and I, again, just wanting to make sure that we don't have an election where all of a sudden Oregon is going to define the presidential election, and it's coming down to 500 votes, and, for example, we have ballots that weren't signed, that people were called, that weren't called, these sorts of things, and so that's, again, we don't think we're doing anything wrong, we don't want any hostile phone calls. Nothing about that one. But yeah, appreciate that. We appreciate you guys being here. Thank you so much.
And thank you very much for coming to our community.
Mr. Chair, I noticed we have a representative of the Secretary of State's office. Would it be possible to call him COVID? I might ask a brief question.
I talked to him way too much in the rules. No, I'm just joking. Jesse, from the Secretary of State's office, Jesse Cornett is here. Do you mind coming forward? I'll dismiss. You guys are out in the hot seat. Thank you so much for being here. Please call or email any of our committee members at any time if you have any questions. Representative Green, if you ask him if he does some work for us, I
appreciate it. I know this is true.
Well, he's trailing us. I'm not $91 per deal. Representative Green,
thank you, sir. Jesse, Section 2 of this bill talks about the security of off-site official voting sites. Does the Secretary of State have a set of standards for how these official voting sites, or whatever they're called?
It's Representative Clinton. I'm not sure if I understand the question.
I'm sorry. The term is voting sites or something else?
Right.
Yeah. I was asking the question is, does the Secretary of State provide a set of standards for what those boxes can be, who can be watching now?
what, I mean, this is defining some very specific things. Are there any standards in place, Ron?
A chair gets represented in a company that is governed by the vote by name, and that's what most of the other aspects of the governance of a vote by mail.
How clear it can be where they need to be locked or not locked, what, who has observed them? This bill puts together a bunch of standards for it, and I was wondering what the current standards are.
I don't have a vote by mail manual with me. That actually might have even been a better question for the clerks, since they're dealing with it. But I believe it's laid out in there.
You can get it with the current just
yes.
Thank you.
Well,
thanks, Mr. Chair.
Jesse, thank you. And Jesse, a kudos to Jesse. Jesse travels around the state with us on behalf of the Secretary of State's office and does a great job representing the Secretary of State and is always quick to answer any questions that we may have. So thank you for being here.
Maybe you could be at committee. I will need somebody who can answer a question also.
Thank you. Thank you, Jesse. Calling the city, nobody else to testify on House Bill 2551. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2551 and thank everybody for testifying on it. At this time, committee, we will open up public hearing on HJR 1. Please, if you could read the bill summary of HJR 1.
Mr. Chair, HJR 1 has been supporting Constitution to require annual sessions on years not to exceed 120 days, even years not to exceed 60 calendar days.
Thank you, Kudish. This time we have one person signed up to testify on HJR 1, and that's Elizabeth Schiller. Good night. Great, thank you. You'd be surprised at how many names I have butchered over the years around the nine city stops, and that's why I apologize to you in advance always. Thank you for being here. Please stick with me ever.
Elizabeth Schiller, I'm currently chair of the Pendleton School Board and public policy chair of the Pendleton branch of the American Association of University Women. And I do want to apologize to Chair Kitts.
Yes.
I didn't think I was going to be here today, and I typed this out really quick, and I realized I left the S off the end of your name on the written testimony, so.
I've been called more if I assure you that.
I am testifying in favor of this resolution. I think it's high time that Oregon does go to an annual legislative session. As a school board member, I think I speak for our entire school board and our administrators and our teachers with frustration that we have trying to get our budget done and plan next year's activities when often we don't have a figure to work with until well after our budgeting session, especially 2 years ago, when we didn't know until August. As many of you know, teacher contract law is very specific as to when you can do certain actions. And right now, we're waiting as, we're pushing it right to the edge as when we may have to institute a RIF, depending on what the final budget is. We've cut $5 million over the last 5 years from our school budget. We have been able to do it without ripping any teachers. We've closed an elementary school. We've raised pay to play. We have reduced our staff by 23%, all through attrition. Unfortunately, we are bare bones right now. If we are looking at cutting anything over the minimum, if we get the 5.375 that the House, that the Senate Democrats are talking about, we can probably avoid a RIF.
And we can we get a definition of RIF?
I'm sorry, reduction in force. But it has to actually think that teachers. I worked for the Forest Service for years, and it's just part of my vocabulary. And having that annual session and the time limit, I was thrilled to see having a 120-day time limit on that first session. It would give school boards and other state agencies the time they need to plan. And then, and I think for our legislators, hopefully it would eliminate those special sessions if we have another terrible crash in our economy, and it allows them the second year to go back and tweak the budget. I believe, as Jerry Wilson said in the newspaper last night, the superintendent from Hermiston, it does allow you that flexibility as our budgeting changes, because
the economy is too unpredictable to project 2 years out, and this would help us in many, many different ways. And just to end, I would like to say, if for some reason this does not pass, I hope that you would still consider imposing time limits on the current session, because otherwise they tend just to go on and on with no end.
You know, I would tell you that you have articulated in 3 minutes the exact reason for this bill. And that's why I support the bill. I think the defined amount of time. The problem is that in the Oregon legislature is you can have partisan gridlock for an infinite amount of time. There's no statutory requirement to leave it. So the Democrats want this, the Republicans want that, and you sit there. If you had a defined amount of time, my thought is it would force a bipartisan, it would force compromise, because look at the defined deadline. You're coming, best get the school budget out, because you got a defined deadline, otherwise nothing gets done. And that's it's for those reasons, the exact reasons that you've articulated. So in 3 minutes, you've done that. It took legislative council 3 weeks to draft. So thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate you all coming to Pendleton.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair Cable. Elizabeth, I appreciate your testimony a lot on this, and I appreciate the points that you're making. Mr. Chair, I'd like to play a little with the devil's advocate, and also maybe add, before I do that, a comment in favor of the merger of the bill that we're looking at. And just as an observation, and I've made this statement with the press here today, I don't know of any corporation in America other than the 4 or 5 state governments that have their board of directors meet only every year, or pay them so fairly. I was not going to get into that representative, but if you introduce a flyer, it will allow me to expand upon that. And as a consequence, I think that makes an incredibly important point as far as the legislature, which I believe to be the board of directors of the government, the larger state government. So, but having said that, and I get to maybe to Chuck Kitts' comment about the paper legislators, at the present time, plus or minus some change, legislators make about $1,200 a month. I think everyone would appreciate that's almost a negative cash flow sort of thing as far as the people who serve in the legislature. Many people are able to do that, to make that commitment, or in essence that sacrifice, because they only have to meet every other year. And they're able, whether it's their own business or whether they're working for someone else, be that public or private employer, they're able to get a leave for that, you know, every other year sort of basis. Perhaps not with pay, but at least for, you know, a leave to do that. If we go to an annual session, for me, one of the things I think we need to consider, Mr. Chairman, is the issue of having to every year make at least a 2 month, if not longer, trip to serve, and that for a citizen legislature, which is what we basically have in Oregon. And I admit that I don't fit well in some ways into the mold because I'm retired and therefore I have nothing else to do with my time, and as I told my wife when she asked me if I was going to run again, what else would I do? But that's not the case with many, and it's also not the case with many young people. We have a lot of young people who, by my definition of young, I mean that may vary, but who are unable, and I know some here in Pendleton, who are unable to run because they got two kids in college, you know, and they can't afford to take that cut and pay sort of thing to go. It only, I think, becomes worse if we go to annual sessions. And having said that, I don't know the chair that I'm looking for Elizabeth to give us a response to it, although I would welcome hearing anything that she has. It's probably more of my comments to the committee that you address this problem.
Representative Jensen, Chairman Jensen, I think your comments are wise, and I think they are accurate. As someone that has participated in the process, realizing that I don't have two kids in college and not too far graduated from
set. If I run for office and I win, this is what is required of me. It's in session, you are working. In fact, just because you're in session, you're working less in session than you are when you're not in session, because when you're not in session is when you're talking to the people and you're out there doing community events and so on and so forth, and you don't simply turn your phone off and say, I realize that you're not getting the medicine from the American Health Plan, but I'm not in session now. You don't say that. It's a full-time job, and the compensation is minimal. And the problem is, it's not so much that you have green legislators that want to make a ton of money. The problem is, it becomes a very exclusive club of those that can afford to serve. And you effectively create a body where, I call it three people that can serve, and I've said it time and time again, and there are very few that break that rule that you're either independent and wealthy, and can afford to take the time off. You either retire and have the time and another income coming in from retirement, or you have a spouse that will support your political habit.
Not tell for those that can't make $1,200 a month in the other way.
What are you going to do if you're all free, so don't worry about it. You're also the smartest member that I've ever said, so it's compounded. You don't get either. So, colleagues, this is a good bill. This is the discussion that will go on about this bill is the exact time frames, what's required, but I do think that Representative Jensen raises some of the points that defining amount of time, Elizabeth defines the amount of time for school reasons, but also every other budget for that matter. So appreciate you being here. I'll let you out the hot seat. I think there's probably there are comments, not questions.
Oh, good question?
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me on a question that's...
I will indulge you on your question.
Yes.
You have to raise it that way.
Just one that's slightly off topic here, but appropriate for me, Sheila. And I want to know how much the Hamilton School District was carrying over or carried over from the last budget year to this budget year, and how that compares to the last few budget years.
Well, what we tried to do, and unfortunately I don't have the numbers in my head, a few years ago I forgot about all the numbers that we have in my head. We voted several years ago to keep a minimum of 5% in our reserve fund. That way, when boiler goes, if there's a major problem, we can cover it and have the funding. For the 2003-2004 school year, we budgeted at the $4.8 billion amount, not knowing what was going to happen. And of course, with the defeat of Measure 30, so we ended up, you know, we got them that extra money in 2003-2004, which is what has allowed us to continue in the 2004-2005 year without making any serious cuts. It kind of was an extra reserve because we knew that this was going to happen. The way that things have been going, we knew we needed that extra money, but generally we don't keep more than 5% in the upcoming budget process. In order to get to those numbers that are on the page of $375,000 up to $1.1 million, that includes a reduction of our carryover funds of 4%. I did see in the newspaper about some districts having a carryover of 20% in the last school year, and I wondered how many of those districts did exactly what we did and kept extra money from the previous year, knowing that we were going to be hit extra hard this year. About it, we generally have more than 5% of our funds in our budget. And that's what the banks, the bonds, the financial community recommends is a minimum.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you for your indulgence. That's a great question. And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Very valuable. I think there's no further questions if you just simply comments by the committee. But you're involved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one comment about HJR 1 in regards to the discussion of it being a good idea to be able to do our budget once a year. Sounds like a good idea, but I just want to throw out that, you know, there may be a fiscal impact to the state of Oregon as well. I would guess, and I don't know for sure, but possibly cost the state more money to turn on the lights of the Capitol as such and actually run the legislature every year as opposed to every other year, which may have an overall impact on our
I think that's a great point, and I would also submit to the committee that the totality of the annual sessions can be deployed by the legislature, whatever we see fit. And if, in fact, you were to limit it to 120 or 90, if you were to add those up, be it earlier, if you were to add those up, it would probably be less time than we actually served last session.
Not 160.
I'm sorry?
120 and 60.
120, yes, 120 and 60 is what this proposal does.
You say you mean 120 and 90?
Yes, I'm sorry. And I think that that's up to discussion of the committee, what would the legislature could adequately, what we would adequately need to do the business of the people. And I think that the savings to the people of Oregon, although the legislative process may be a bit more expensive, and I agree with that, the savings and the effectiveness of the legislature would probably more than make up for that. So, Mr. Jensen, final comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recognize the issue of determining where, what the fiscal might be on this is in the fiscal department. So, but I would submit that it may not be as great as might be thought, because first of all, as you point out, the number of days probably will be about the same. Secondly, I think there really is no increase in staffing, or the relatively little increase in staffing, since most of the staff that we have around the building are on the lights in the building, are on, because it is the public's building, around the clock, 12 months a year, so it probably would in some ways cost a little more, or might in some ways cost a little more, in some ways it might save a little bit. The big prevailing issue, it would seem to me, on this issue that this committee needs to keep in mind is what is the best public policy for the state of Oregon.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody. And I would just, as I do every committee, I would thank my committee for traveling with us over here. This committee, and I say this every committee meeting, is the most active committee in the state legislature. We're making 9 city stops discussing these issues because we feel it that important, which is probably more stops than most of the other committees combined. And the toll that these people have taken is absolutely amazing. They've spent 5 of the last 6 weekends on the road, and I know Representative Dalton, Representative Newman are now heading to another committee meeting in Baker. Representative Thatcher drove over last night from a committee meeting in Bend. So, thank you, committee. I appreciate it. And at this time, we will close the public hearing on HJR 1 from the adjourn. Thank you.